I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Once it was just a bird, or a fish, or a flower. But the art of folding pieces of paper, the art known as origami, changed while you weren't watching. Now there are elaborate creatures, long-horned beetles and scorpions, and unimaginably complicated creations like clocks and geometric puzzles. The art, the challenge of constructing something from a single sheet of paper now involves high-powered computers, the wisdom of engineers, and the genius of mathematicians. So our question on today's program, is it art, or is it engineering, or could it possibly be both? The beauty of the origami sculpture is enough to distract most of us from what the experts see in its algebraic formula, its polygons and theorems of existence. Perhaps origami is indeed that perfect nexus of the practical and the improbable. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is one of the world's ranking experts in the art of origami. His name is Robert Lang. He's a physicist and an engineer, but now a full-time artist and author of a number of books on origami. Welcome to the program, Robert. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Latest book, Origami Design Secrets, with how-tos in it or just pictures of what is possible?
Origami Design Secrets tells you how to design origami. There's lots of origami books. Most of them have step-by-step instructions. Here's how to fold 3 or 4 or 20 or 30
right.
individual figures. What I've tried to do in Origami Design Secrets is to teach people the underlying rules of design so people can actually go out and not just fold someone else's model, but design their own original figures.
And if you want to take a look at some of these original figures, I send you to our website at www.theconnection.org. We have a gallery of some of Robert's finest work, which we've nicked from his own website. So you can either look at it on our site at theconnection.org or go to langorigami.com, where there are those pictures and more about origami itself. You said that you want to try and get people past this idea of just following the instructions. I always thought that's just what origami was, because as a kid, maybe I'm just like you. I had, you know, some squares of paper given to me and how to make a bird. It wasn't a very good bird, but at least, you know, there was step A and step B and step C. What's beyond following the instructions?
Well, to get to step A, step B, step C, at some point in the past, someone had to come up with that figure to begin with. And a lot of those simple figures that we all learned in schools were developed decades ago or even hundreds of years ago. But if you want to make something that you've never seen before, if you're inspired by a particular subject or you just want to exercise a little bit more complexity, then you need to be able to design origami. In the past, people designed origami by something between intuition and trial and error. They'd fold a sheet of paper, manipulate it different ways, see what it started to resemble. If it started to resemble a subject, then you'd try to take it there a little bit further. And that's worked to come up with probably hundreds of origami figures. But if you want to do something...
A lot of paper in the waste paper basket.
A lot of paper in the waste paper basket on the way. But if you want to do something that's really complex or very specialized, like a particular beetle or a clock or a particular type of airplane, it's unlikely you're going to find that by trial and error and intuition. And what I and various other origami artists developed over the last couple of decades is a set of techniques that we could use to make specific shapes. We could start with an idea of a subject and break it down into a collection of fundamental shapes and then figure out what are the creases you need in the paper that'll make that exact set of shapes.
Now, one of yours is that tree theory, is that right?
That's right. Tree theory is the name we gave to a collection of ideas about how to make shapes that resemble trees, meaning the shapes that have long skinny parts, branches.
So, but a vertical spine as well, right?
That's right. Basically, any stick figure with a vertical spine could be made using this tree theory. And since an awful lot of origami subjects can be approximated pretty well by drawing a stick figure with a vertical spine, this set of techniques worked to design a pretty large number of origami figures.
Now, would we have to do that? You've got a piece of gold, a square of gold paper, a light foil. Is that a favorite of yours for folding the piece of paper that's on the table in front of you?
Paper I'm using for folding, which is foil-backed paper. It looks kind of like wrapping paper. It's got gold foil on one side and white on the other. It's nice for practicing because the metal part of the foil takes the shape. When I make a crease, it'll stay in place. And so if I'm practicing a new design, I'll use this paper because it folds really neatly.
Can you show me something of the tree theory with that piece of paper, or do we need a computer for that?
We don't need a computer, but we'd probably need a pencil and paper. Tree theory relates, you draw a stick figure, and then you can represent the different lines of that stick figure by geometric shapes on a square of paper. So we'll draw a square of paper, and then we'd use circles and these little meandering curves called rivers to represent the different lines of the stick figure. And by sort of packing circles into a square, like you might pack cans into a square box, that gives the distribution of the paper what parts of the square go into each flap of the folded shape. So it's a pencil and paper exercise, would probably take about half an hour to go through.
When does the paper get involved? I'd like to see you create something, hear you create something with this. I'm just wondering if you end up designing all your instructions on a computer screen on paper and pencil, and then you go, right, and sit down with the paper and actually produce what it is you've conceived of.
I'll do most of my design on pencil and paper. Some of the time I use a computer. There are certain types of designs where the relationships between the parts are so complex that I need to use a computer to get into the design. But for most of them, it's just pencil and paper. And I'll work for anywhere from half an hour to a couple of days on the paper design. But at some point, you have to get the paper involved. So once I've worked out a crease pattern, then I take a sheet of paper, start folding from the crease pattern, and fold it up, and usually I'll get the shape that I started out designing. And that's where the real art begins, because once you've got this shape that sort of looks like a stick figure, now you need to turn it into the actual subject. And that's the part that I can actually demonstrate a little bit here with folding, because you do a lot of shaping. You can start with a very angular geometric shape and add shaping to make it curved and smoothed and rounded and more closely resemble the subject.
Show me what you are talking about here.
So I'll fold a very simple figure. In fact, this is a figure that I used in the workshop. This one can actually be done in just a few minutes, and it takes only about 10 folds.
We're starting to look like a paper airplane because it was folded first down the middle and then the wings in as if it was to be an airplane. But now you folded it back on itself. I don't think I'm good enough to keep up with your hands here.
Yeah, I'm going pretty fast. But this figure is a simple duck, and it can be... I teach it to beginners, and it can be folded even by a beginner in about 10 or 15 minutes.
This is like the origamist's version of doodling, is it?
That's right. And this is a pretty simple shape. It's very angular. We've got a duck, we've got wings, we've got a tail, we've got a head, we've got a beak, but everything is sort of sharp and angular and very geometric. And that's the kind of shape that comes out of a tree theory design. But then I'll start to do a little bit of shaping and rounding. So on this duck, I'd fold the tip of its bill under, and I pinch it so that it's got kind of a flat duck's bill, and round the head a little bit. And the neck is a little bit fat, so I'll fold in a little bit of the paper to narrow the neck.
Once you get into doing curves, though, it becomes pretty complicated. I mean, I've seen a fish that you've done with rounded scales and a moose with round shoulders. I mean, that's it still has to be done with folding, right? There's no scissors on the table.
That's right. Everything is one sheet, no cuts. So if you want to get curves, and I'm putting some curves into this duck's wing, you need to make curved creases.
But isn't that just something like a potter would make a pot? Where does the math come in the curves that you're now putting into this little sculpture?
Well, in the curves that you put in, you can't make an arbitrary curved surface. There's a mathematical laws that specify a relationship between the curvature of one surface on one side of a crease and the curvature on the other side of a crease, and the curvature of the crease itself. And those three curves are linked, so you can't make any old curve. You need to understand the relationship, that this curve on the wing mm-hmm. has to be convex, and then the curve on the other side of the crease has to be concave. So if I'm folding an origami model, I need to figure out a way in which the curve that, if I want it convex, that convex curve has to be shown, and the concave curve attached to it shows up in a place where concavity works.
Was there a moment in your own history of folding paper when some light went on about the link between mathematics and origami? Because you, like I, started as a kid doing this, right?
That's right. I started at the age of six. And when I was a kid, origami was just a fun thing to do. And even in my early teens, I started developing my own models just because I couldn't find the subjects I wanted to fold in books. I couldn't find a book that had an eagle in it, so I'd go out and try to make up my own eagle and designed it by this sort of trial and error process. And following my own intuition. But it turned out that I was pretty good at following my intuition. I could come up with a lot of new models. And as a kid, I didn't realize that that was actually fairly unusual. But once I got to college, I was educated as an engineer. At Caltech, you learn a lot of basic math, and you learn how to apply mathematical tools to solving your homework problems in engineering. And it just felt natural to try to use some of those tools to solve some of the problems I was seeing in origami in coming up with a figure. And it turned out that a lot of origami is susceptible to using mathematical tools to improve the folding. So that kind of took off after college.
Well, what about that transition from work as a laser physicist, an engineer, to a work as a full-time origami author and artist?
Well, origami has been a hobby my whole life. And starting in college, it became a very important hobby. And so when I was out in the working world, you know, working as a researcher and then as a manager of R&D, I was always doing origami at home, nights and weekends. And it just grew. I wrote a lot of my books during nights and weekends.
Yeah.
And the origami side of my life just kept growing. So when 3 years ago, I had an opportunity to decide whether I was going to let origami keep expanding but limit it to this small part of my life, or I could let it grow and take over a large part of my life, I chose the latter. The single event that crystallized this was this idea of this design book. I knew that I had been thinking about this book for 10 years. I wanted to write a book that brought together all the techniques that I'd learned over 20 years of designing origami. And I also realized that I needed to focus exclusively on that book. And so that was the event that I said, okay, I'm going to quit lasers, I'm going to do origami full-time, and I'm going to spend the next year writing this book.
Which is called Origami Design Secrets. The author, Robert Lang, is my guest this hour. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Welcome to join our conversation about that curious connection that exists between the art of origami and the mathematics that's required to make the more complicated stuff work, how you talk to engineers and mathematicians and four-year-old children who are just trying to make ducks. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Robert Lang is with me in the studio. He's one of the pioneers of computational origami, the author of a number of books on the subject. We'll talk a little bit later in the program about origami insects. The latest book's called Origami Design Secrets. We'd like to have you join us on the program. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. Robert Lang is here. Is his duck, which is now sitting elegantly on the table between the two of us. We're going to take our first call from Natick, Massachusetts, and Peter's with us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing, Dick?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. Here's my question. My 8-year-old daughter is able to whip out hundreds of these origami cranes and other figures in very quick time. Although she is at best an average mathematician in her elementary school classes.
Now, do you mean she's got a couple of designs figured out, Peter, and she cranks them out like an assembly line, or she's got a lot of variety as well?
She has a number of basic designs that she will do lots of, but she's now beginning to have a bigger repertoire.
And she's 8.
And she's 8 years old. and my wife and I are both mathematicians and engineers. And I'm just, I guess my question is, does her ability to manipulate the paper show a sign that she is bound for a mathematician or engineering future? And I'm on a cell phone, so I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks for your question.
It could be because there are a lot of mathematicians who are good at origami, but there are also some incredible origami artists who are not mathematicians. So your daughter could be destined, for example, as a career as a banker, as a high school teacher, as a malacologist, a person who studies seashells, because some of the best origami artists in the world have those careers.
And this is the part that I find fascinating. You now lecture on the subject, but I can't imagine how you find the different language to speak to the different audiences. Give us an example of the sort of contrast that you'll have to deal with.
So for a beginner audience or someone who just wants to learn how to fold, we'll talk about very tangible things. Here's how you make a fold. How does the crease feel under your finger?
Give me a piece of paper. Pass one across here. Now tell me what I should be paying attention to
here. Okay. For example, if we're going to fold this square of paper in half from corner to corner,
okay,
there's different ways of doing it. We'll bring one corner to the other. But the best way to do it is not to try to align the two corners and then squash the paper.
Not the two tips
flat.
And then squash that?
Nope.
What I've been doing all my life.
That's
okay.
Right. But once you've done a little origami, you realize the best way to fold it in half is to roughly align the two corners, then go back and look at the two corners where the crease hits and make
the two ends of the diagonal where the crease will be. Okay, so get right on that point
there.
That's
right. Make that crease a little sharp at one end.
Yeah, okay,
take your other hand, make the crease a little sharp at the other end.
Right.
Spread your fingers out over the crease and then pat the crease flat and then slowly flatten
it. Now, does it matter how hard the crease is? Should I be thinking about that at all along?
Yes, you should. If the crease is made very sharp, it feels like it's more precise, but if it's made too sharp, that'll weaken the paper, and if you're folding a complicated shape, it's likely to rip along that sharp crease.
So I don't want to run my thumbnail down it at this point. I've got my crease, and okay, we're going to get back to this in a minute. I want to get some of our callers in, too. Somerville, South Carolina. Stacy's with us. Hi, Stacy.
Dick, thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah.
I am so excited. I am thrilled to hear this subject today. And Robert, thank you for writing this book. I'm going to get on the computer today and find out where I can buy it. I, too, have a child that has always had an interest in origami. However, neither of his parents are mathematicians or engineers. This is a child, however, that has an extreme interest in engineering and architecture and would like to pursue that as an adult. The complication here is that this is a kid with ADHD. He's a very gifted student, but he's very unmotivated in algebra this year. And I sure wish Robert was going to be doing a speaking tour near Charleston, South Carolina, because I would bring my son to meet him. The interesting thing about origami and how it's affected our family's life is that when our son was younger and the hyperactivity aspect of his problem was so pronounced, the origami would center him. He loved for me to find him new books, and we always kept a vast supply of origami papers in the house for him.
And this is the one time, Stacy, when you would get him sitting quiet, concentrating, right?
So unbelievably focused on whatever he was making. And like the little girl that the gentleman talked about before, you know, he started out with the real basic things, but eventually it evolved to the really complicated things.
Well, I tell you something, Stacy. I want you to get your son to take a peek at our website at theconnection.org to see what some of the possibilities of a real master are with origami. Robert, I wonder if the same still works for you. Do you find that, you know, the art of folding something can be a completely absorbing and centering activity?
I feel such a kinship with your son because when I'm starting to design a model or fold a model, I get going and time time flies. I get so absorbed in either the design or the folding, I look up and hours have passed, or it's dark outside. And origami has that effect on some people. You teach a class of 25 kids, 24 of them will fold the shape, say that was fun and go off, and the 25th gets hooked.
All right, now we were starting earlier with the idiot class here. I'm going to call myself the idiot class. I know you don't call it that. We've made the one fold in our piece of paper. But if you were talking with a group of young mathematicians and trying to make that connection between the art of folding the paper and what it is they're trying to make sense of in their textbook, would you be going at it a different way?
I would. If I was teaching a class of students about math or the connections between math and origami, I wouldn't care whether you make the crease sharp or smooth. I would just take them through some folds that establish a couple neat basic properties about origami. And I can do that with you. We folded the paper in half once. Take it, fold it in half roughly again. It doesn't even have to be in half. Any old way so that you've created a corner somewhere in the middle of the paper.
Yeah, all right.
And now you can take one of those flaps or both of the flaps and fold it back any distance, any direction. Just make sure your crease hits the same corner in the middle of the paper.
Not precise at all. This is not math.
It doesn't have to be precise, and that's the beauty.
You know, like a badly folded dinner napkin.
There's so much more to math than what gets taught in the schools, and this is a way of teaching people that math is fun, and it doesn't. Some aspects of it don't even need to be precise. So we've made a fold. We could do a couple more, but we'll stop here.
Fair enough.
Now we're going to unfold the paper.
The whole thing?
The whole thing, all the way. And roughly flatten it, but we don't want to lose the direction of the creases. Now, you'll notice we've got a bunch of creases that radiate out from a single point, kind of like rays from a star. And some of those creases poke upward like little ridges, and other creases poke downward like little valleys.
You call these mountain creases or valley creases,
and we call these mountain and valley creases. Now, if you go around that point and count the number of mountain folds, we may have different values.
I have two mountain and four valley. Is that possible?
That's possible. On my sheet, I've got four mountain and two valley. So we have different numbers of mountains and valleys, but the difference between the two is two. Four minus two is two. If we'd met a few extra folds, we'd have five and three, six and four. And so this is a property that's been proven to be mathematically proven as characteristic of all origami. And so I'd show the kids in math that you can discover mathematical properties about folding just by simple things, folding and counting.
Man, where were you when I was in grade 9? 1-800-423-8255 to Catherine now, who's joining us from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I'm just so thrilled that you are doing a program on origami.
Is this a passion of yours?
Yes, it is. My grandmother, she was Japanese. I'm half. When we were stationed in Japan, we used to live real close to them. And one summer, when I was about 8, she decided to sit me down. And she didn't speak English. And I didn't speak Japanese.
How old were you?
I was about 8. And she handed me a piece of paper. She had one, and she made a fold and waited till I copied. And we went through until I folded a crane. And I was hooked. From that day.
Could you ever do stuff on your own, Catherine? I started the program by saying I'm one of those people who really always needs to be shown where and how to fold it. Did you get beyond that?
I basically have collected a lot of books. I always think of myself as not being the one who's really creative in designing things, but I can sure follow directions. And I've got a collection of about 25 origami books. One of them is by Mr. Lang, and I'm definitely going to look for this one, and maybe I can start doing some creating. But this is something I've done. When we moved back to the mainland, I used to fold cranes and the paper balls and flowers, and I would line them. I used notebook paper.
Let me stop you if I can, Catherine. I'm just curious to know in Robert's mind whether or not the shift from following the instructions to grasping the theory is something that's within my reach and Catherine's reach.
I think it's within everyone's reach. If you can follow the instructions, you can perform the folds that make a shape, and you'll start to develop an intuitive notion of what's possible. You know, that, for example, you can't ever make the paper longer than it starts with. If I have a square like the square we're working with, it's about 10 inches long. If I measure its diagonal, it's about 14 inches long. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can fold that into a shape that's 20 inches long.
Right.
And everyone will intuitively appreciate that, and it wouldn't be a surprise to anyone. And a lot of the concepts of design are as intuitive as that. And so I think actually anyone who could follow directions to make origami models has within them the ability to design origami figures.
There is on our webpage your moose origami. I don't know how big it is because it's only a photograph. How tall is that moose?
The one that's on the webpage is quite small. It's only about 6 inches high, and it's folded from a sheet of paper that's about 18-inch square.
See, I looked at it, and I thought it must have been sort of 4 feet by 4 feet in order to get it down to the size. There's one other thing that Catherine raised that was a question that I had, and that is how much the history, the creativity of origami is rooted in Japan.
Well, the art goes back hundreds of – the craft of origami goes back hundreds of years in Japan. And we don't actually know how old it is in Japan. People have speculated ages even going back into the 600 AD. But the only solid evidence we have are some sort of printed record, and those are much more recent. The oldest images that we have of origami figures are, I think, from about the 1700s in Japan. But they show many origami figures, which tell us that the art was pretty well developed already by then. So this craft goes back hundreds of years. But as an art form, the creation of new models is almost entirely a 20th century phenomenon. And it was
still based in Japan or a lot of it coming from Western countries now?
It's been worldwide since about the 50s and 60s. Japan has a very deep tradition of origami, and so there is still a great deal of both traditional origami in Japan and a lot of development of new figures. Some of the best folders in the world are in Japan. But for the last 50 years, it's been worldwide, and so you find world-class origami artists in the U.S., Britain, France, and elsewhere.
And they're okay with the moose, right? The fact that it's not an enormously elaborate flower or something, that it's the skill or it's whatever it can be created. This is how people judge a piece of origami sculpture?
I think they judge it on different criteria. What's nice is they now judge it like an art form. Do you have an emotional response when you see it?
Right.
In days past, people judge things more on is it a faithful copy of the subject, because most origami is representational. But I think people have kind of moved past that a little bit, and they judge it more as a piece of art. Does it speak to the viewer in some way?
We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're not just talking about the emotional response or the beauty or the elegance of something, but also about the math that underlies it. We'd like to have you with us on the program. Going next to Waterloo, Iowa, and Mary's with us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question going to the math that lies behind this.
Yeah.
I studied math in college and abandoned it decades ago, but I still remember taking a topology class, and we were talking about the difference between shapes and spaces and how you could map one shape to another shape. And the ultimate conclusion that I remember the instructor saying some 20-some years ago was that the only fundamental difference between shapes was inside and outside, that up and down weren't meaningful and right and left and so forth. And I'm wondering, is there a relationship between that and the mathematics behind origami and the shapes of origami?
You mean, can everything be seen in terms of is it an inside or is it an outside surface?
Right.
Topology often can be described as all the things that stay the same when you're working with rubber material, things that can stretch. So if you can stretch one shape into another, they're the same. So there are some things that don't change, like the number of holes in a sheet. You can't remove a hole by stretching. In origami, what you can fold is limited by topology. If the shape you're trying to fold has a hole, since you can't cut the paper, you can't really make a hole, but you can kind of fake it by folding the paper into a ring and folding the joint so it's not very obvious. So in some sense, topology does limit what you can do with paper. But a big restriction that comes from folding paper is that, unlike topological surfaces, the paper can't be stretched or compressed. And so that actually sets much tighter sets of rules on what you can fold than what would be possible from purely topological considerations.
And I haven't even come close to the engineering side of everything that you do, because part of going pro is that, in fact, the art of what you do has value to people who are creating things that we use. I love the example of folding an airbag for a German car manufacturer so it fits inside that little panel on the steering wheel. However did they think to come to an origami master for that kind of wisdom?
Well, engineers know that a good engineer, well, the first thing he does when he gets a new problem is to look around and see what's been done before, because if you can borrow something that someone's already worked, you can save yourself a lot of time and money. And so the engineering team that was working on a computer simulation of airbags, they needed an algorithm, kind of a recipe for how do you figure out the creases that flatten an airbag within a computer simulation. And so they thought, well, let's do a literature search and see if anyone has looked at coming up with designing creases via computer or for simulation. And they found a paper that I'd written, and that's how they got connected to me. And the amazing thing was it turned out that an algorithm, a tool that I had developed for the design of artistic folding, how do you make a duck or an insect or a bird, turned out to be exactly the tool that they needed to find the creases for flattening the airbag. And this often happens in science and technology, that a problem you solve for purely mathematical interest,
right,
or for aesthetic value then someday turns around and has a very practical application. And that's happened several times in the world of origami.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join my conversation this hour. Robert Lang is my guest. We're talking about origami. Japanese word, ora means fold, gami is paper, is that right?
Right.
That's about all the homework that I was able to actually memorize beforehand. But Robert is here as our expert to talk about what it is about that one little sheet of paper which links the artist, the sculptor, the mathematician, and the engineer. We'll talk even a little bit about outer space when we come back after the break. But we'd like to have you join us with your questions, your thoughts on the place of origami, art and beauty and math. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Robert Lang. He used to be a full-time scientist. Now he's a full-time scientist, except it's a little bit different. He's working with origami, folding pieces of paper, doing it on a computer screen, doing it here in the studio, doing it as a lecturer, talking to engineers and students. His new book's called Origami Design Secrets. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. Next call from Wayland, Massachusetts. Peter's with us. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Maybe we all remember struggling through proofs. Geometry proofs in, you know, junior high school with compass and straight edge.
I purged all that, but go on.
I enjoyed it. And one of the things I remember working on was the trisection of an angle. And then that's something that origami can do that you can't do with those tools of Western geometry. I was wondering if Dr. Lang would like to discuss the trisection of an angle with origami.
First to bring us all up to speed with what Peter means by the trisection of an angle. And
right. So the problem of trisection of an angle is very old, 2,000 years old. And the idea is someone gives you an angle, two lines that meet at a point.
Mm-hmm.
Can you divide that into thirds in a mathematically precise way? Now, you know, we can all sort of play around until it looks about right. But is there a way to do it mathematically precisely? And the ancient Greeks tried fruitlessly to do it with a compass and an unmarked straight edge, a ruler that didn't actually have any marks on it. And it wasn't until about the 19th century that mathematicians proved that you couldn't with those two instruments. But if you're folding, if someone drew those two lines on a sheet of paper and then you started folding the paper so you could align points on the paper to each other.
So I would take, Peter, don't go anywhere. You can follow us here with your imagination. I'm taking my piece of paper and I'm making two parallel folds. Is that what I'm doing? Or would you sooner have an angle?
Well, the specific fold, if you have an angle, you'd to make it kind of interesting, you'd
right,
make an angle
you.
That's separate. And you need two parallel folds. And the easiest way to do that is to fold the bottom up, fold it up over again,
right, okay,
and then unfold.
Yeah.
And there's a particular origami move where you bring the corner of the angle to one of your two parallel lines,
right,
and you bring the crease intersection to...
By looking at the other side of the paper, the
right,
crease
by,
on the other side, yeah.
To lie on the angle, the line that forms the angle. And when you make those two alignments at the same time, you fold the corner over, and then one of your parallel lines is now angled. So now I fold the paper along that angled line. And when I unfold everything, I'll complete the angled fold so that it that it runs all the way back to the corner. And that fold has now divided the paper into thirds. And it's been mathematically proven this is an exact angle trisection, and that using folding alone, you can actually do a lot more constructions than are possible with compass and straight edge.
This is, Peter, something I think that you may have played with on your own.
Well, only when it was, you know, demonstrated that it could happen. I mean, it just brought back memories of the 70s for me. But it's just such a beautiful, simple, and powerful method. And I don't know if you or if there are any living masters who can actually do particular portraits of people, but I've actually seen that done live once, and it was incredible.
With a single sheet of paper, Peter?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
And not a really wet piece of paper that's draped over somebody's face.
No, definitely.
Do you know
not.
What Peter's talking about here?
Yeah, the idea of folding faces from paper, there are just a few masters who specialize or who have developed that skill. It's not something that I myself have worked on, but one of the best at it was the 20th century's greatest folder, Akira Yoshizawa, Japanese master, who did many portraits, including a stunning self-portrait.
Were these silhouettes or full-on?
Full facial, front view of the face. And then there's now a master who's probably the world's master at portraits, a French artist named Eric Joiselle, and he does stunning portraits of people and mythical figures and fanciful faces that are just gorgeous.
Is there ever a time when you and this fellow from France or others get together and sort of, hey, what have you been working on? Let me show you what I'm working on.
Yeah, there are national and even international origami conferences. There's in the U.S., there's a conference in New York City in June that happens every year, yeah. Has 600 or 700 people from all over the world attend. It's put on by Origami USA, the American Folding Association. There are similar conferences in Japan. And because they're international, we get quite a bit of attendance from artists. And so most of the origami masters have met each other several times.
And are you working on something now that you will bring to the New York exhibition? I'm not going to ask you necessarily what it is, but, I mean, do you think that far ahead?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's kind of a friendly competition in place for the next competition in June. And if anyone wants to join in, I welcome them. But several of my friends who are designers of complex origami figures, we all agreed we're all going to try to do a hermit crab from a single sheet of paper. That means the crab and the shell from a single sheet. And we'll bring our models to New York in June, and we'll see who's looks best.
Yeah, you've already done a crab. It's on your website, right?
I've actually done two hermit crabs. And so part of the challenge for me is I've got to come up with an entirely new way of doing a hermit crab. And in a way that is somehow an improvement on what I've done before, because you don't want to do the same thing twice. And besides, everyone else is going to kind of be gunning for me, topping what I've done before. So I'll have to do better just to keep up.
All right. To Acton, Massachusetts for our next call. Judy's with us. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is great. I was sitting folding a crane from polymer clay as your show started. I have a degree in chemistry and MBA, strong in math and science, but now work full-time as an artist, and had done a lot of origami on and off throughout my life. And like a lot of the other callers, I have a young daughter who is amazing with origami. But when I started playing with polymer clay about a year and a half ago, one of the first things I said is, ooh, I wonder if I can do a crane with this.
Now, help me out a second here, Judy. When you talk about polymer clay, you're talking about a thin sheet of it?
It's what I do is I roll it out very thin. Most people know of it as Sculpey, the stuff that kids play with.
Fimo, the other sort of brand names.
Stuff.
Okay.
And so I use some of the better brands that are more durable and not as brittle. But I've figured out how to roll it, and you can't do as much creasing, and it's sort of a finesse of folds. But it sort of stretches the challenge of origami to work within the material within the constraint.
Mm-hmm.
that you're usually using with traditional origami. And I wonder if Mr. Lang has done any work with other materials other than paper.
Yeah, in origami, most of what we work with is paper, but people have explored lots of different materials. In fact, here in the studio, we're working with foil-backed paper, which is kind of metal and foil. I've worked with metal mesh. I've worked with sheet metal. Some of the most fun folding is to make edible origami. You can fold flour tortillas, wonton wrappers, phyllo doughs, even made things from sycamore leaves. So there's a limit on what you can fold imposed by the constraints of the material, but you can fold with an amazing number of things.
There you go, Judy. Dinner at the Langs. It's like, is that a napkin or is that food? 1-800-423-8255. There is, though, another professional application, which I kind of like, and that is a task that you had of folding up the lens. You tell me, the lens of a telescope?
Yeah, this was a project that was started at Lawrence Livermore National Labs, and the program was to develop a telescope that ultimately would go up into space and have a main lens that's 100 meters across. So football
100 meters across.
Football field-sized lens. And this lens would be made from a very thin sheet of plastic, and the only way you can get something that big up into space is to fold it down pretty small so that it fits inside a rocket. So they, being good engineers, said, let's go find out if anyone has looked at folding surfaces in a mathematical way, and they eventually tracked me down, and I got involved with them, and together we worked out a couple of folding patterns, one of which they adopted for their first prototype, which enables this big sheet of plastic, and eventually they changed from plastic to glass with hinges at the folds, but made this pattern that the lens could fold down, built a lens 5 meters in diameter, kind of a small size test, tried it out on a test range with a powerful laser at Livermore, and it worked like a charm.
Now, wait a second. It's one thing to fold it up, but if you're sending it out into space, there has to be someone or something that unfolds it once it gets out there. How is that managed?
Part of the folding pattern was, or one of the rules or constraints that the folding pattern had to satisfy was something that could be unfolded in a pretty systematic way.
And like pulling a string or...
Or even when it's all unfolded, if it's kind of tucked in radially, you could just spin it around and let the centrifugal force cause the edges to unfold.
Now, has one of these gone into space yet, or is that yet to come?
The lens that these guys did, they built a 5-meter lens, which was terrestrial, and I believe their program has ended, so that won't go into space. But there are a lot of other folding structures that are being designed for space, and just this last August actually flew. JAXA, the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, flew a solar sail that's pleated, kind of like an umbrella, although it looks like an eight-leaf clover.
Yeah.
And they deployed it successfully in space. And I think coming up next March, the Cosmos mission will also be deploying a solar sail in space,
which is folded very carefully before it goes up.
I imagine. I'm not involved with either of those, but that's kind of what you have to do to get a thin sheet that's really big up into space.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the lines and to Hamilton, Massachusetts. Sue's on the line. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I'm calling today because I'm just so interested in the way that origami gives me sort of a door on math. I'm an artist, mm-hmm. and math is just so uncomfortable for me, and I've always done okay with it, but avoid it where I can. I found that the only math that I could ever enjoy was geometry. It made total sense to me, and I think it's that same sort of part of my brain that enjoys origami. I've always found that folding the paper, it's beautiful how the form comes out. As a sculptor, I enjoy that, but it makes sense to me where the paper can go with the creases, what shapes I can make by pushing, a certain amount of it in, it taking some away. It gives it a certain amount of body, a certain shape. But I find that my biggest joy in origami is I'll get to a part in the directions where the illustrations don't work. It just doesn't quite do it for the really complex pieces. And I'll just sit there holding the paper for a bit and just kind of rest my mind on it, and then suddenly it'll happen. I understand where I have to fold it, and boom, it's there. And I just wanted to comment on the fact that there's sort of a blending of art and creativity and math that is, it's kind of beautiful. It's exciting to be a non-math person and feel like I'm indulging in that after taking geometry in high school. I thought, oh, no wonder I understand this and no wonder I enjoy origami. I was wondering if you could speak to that, if you've talked to people who have difficulties with math but can kind of begin to understand it or geometry through the paper folding.
All right, Sue, thanks for your call.
For a lot of people, math is a pretty scary place. You know, it's all these algebra, X's and Y's and things. And origami has so many ties to math and through different ways. It's a way of kind of creeping up and peering over the fence and maybe even crawling over the fence and walking around on the borders to experience some math. And different parts of math appeal to different ways of thinking. Origami is very geometric. It's very three-dimensional. It works in terms of lines and surfaces and concrete things we can visualize. And that's a way of experiencing and appreciating that part of math, even if all the formal algebra and letters are still a little bit intimidating.
But the other part of it is that for somebody who is not in any way intimidated by those letters and the formula can also take this great pleasure in the creation of something that's so simple. That's what I like coming back to with it, is that you begin with something that's so simple.
That was the original appeal for me, that every origami sheet, every origami figure starts with that plain unfolded sheet. And no matter how complicated the final result is, or simple, like this duck we folded a little bit earlier, it's always fundamentally that same the unfolded sheet. Well, it's no longer unfolded, but it's the same square sheet. No marks, no cuts.
Right.
And that's at the heart of every origami model. And so that connection between every single origami model is something that's beautiful.
Thank you so much for coming. It's fascinating to listen to you talk. Robert Lang, origami artist, former laser physicist, author of a number of books, including Origami Design Secrets, Origami Insects. We didn't get to the insects, but you can see them on our website, or at least a couple of them. We are at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Kevin Sullivan. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diane Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. There's a duck on the table. This is The Connection.